Well, I never thought I'd write anything autobiographical, but the idea came to me in the early 90s when I discovered that I had fairly serious illness, leukemia, from which I still suffer. And it was a chronic leukemia, so that as time went on, I had to have more and more treatment with, unfortunately, less and less results. And then it occurred to me that since roughly at the moment that I was diagnosed with this disease, my mother died. My father had died in 1971, and I was very close to my mother. So it suddenly came to me that the world in which I had grown up was quickly disappearing through the death of my last parent. And I thought it would be rather important for me, at any rate, and also for my children, to write something about the world I grew up in, which had actually disappeared even before. I was born in Jerusalem, and of course, the Palestine that I knew and grew up in, partly, ended in 1948. My family lived also in Egypt, and that country had changed and become totally transformed in 1952 with the revolution against the monarchy. And for a period of 25 years or so, my family would spend the summer in a small village in Lebanon, in the mountains of Lebanon, called Hur Shwer. And that world came to an end in 1975 with the Lebanese Civil War. So my attempt in this book was really to recreate the world of my childhood, which was a very unusual childhood for various reasons, but also the political and social and even, I think, emotional world in which I grew up.
You said you were very close to your mother, and I think that is, to put it mildly, but we may come back to that a little later. But just to keep on for a moment about this environment. It was really, when you read this, it's really a strange world.
Well, yeah.
Some kind of mixture of colonial thing and the Palestine background in Egypt, but still an English-American lifestyle.
The lifestyle wasn't English-American. I went to English and American schools. The story is a very strange one because my father, who was born in 1895 in Jerusalem, left Palestine in 1911 to run away from the Ottoman draft. He was supposed to fight in a war in Bulgaria. So his father told him, you better run away. And he came to the United States. And in the United States, he spent a few years studying and then working. And in 1917, he joined the American Army. He thought they were going to send him to Palestine to fight against the Turks. But instead, he went to France and fought against the Germans. He went back to America for a year or two, became an American citizen, and then in 1920, his mother was dying, and so she summoned him back to Palestine. And he came to Palestine and really stayed in the Middle East for the rest of his life. He went into business with his cousin in Jerusalem. My father was a really extremely brilliant businessman. Very powerful tycoon, really, by the time, because he went in the late 20s, he left Palestine, and founded a branch of the business, which was office equipment, including Swedish office equipment, by the way. By the middle of the war, it was one of the largest businesses in the Middle East, entirely due to my father. And he stayed in Cairo, really, traveling back and forth between there and Palestine, until we lost the business in Palestine. My mother was also Palestinian, but her mother was Lebanese. My mother was born in Nazareth, and then she was sent to school in Beirut, to high school, and then 1 or 2 years of college. And then she met my father. It was an arranged marriage. I think my parents really didn't talk very much about their past, but what I was able to understand is that my mother was not very happy to be married to my father in the beginning, but she then, because she said that she began to love him a great deal as they lived together. And the two of them came then to Egypt. Neither of them was from Egypt. My father was Episcopalian. My mother was the daughter of a Baptist minister, if you can believe such a thing, in Nazareth, who had gone to America and had been converted by the Baptists. You see, in our part of the world, education was very often connected to the foreign missions. So the Baptists came to Nazareth. My father was educated by the English Anglicans in a school that I went to called St. George's in Jerusalem. And it was called, the Anglican mission was called in Arabic, Taifat al-Shilling, which means the congregation of the shilling, because they would, of course, they pay money. And the other interesting thing is that Christians, who are, of course, a minority in the Middle East, were in the end the only successors of the missionaries, the Christian missionaries who came, all of them. They never converted any Muslims. They never converted any Jews. They only converted other Christians. So my parents came from Orthodox, you know, Greek Orthodox background. But then one became a Baptist, and the other one became an Anglican. And they lived in Cairo, where, you know, which is a Muslim country, of course. We were not Egyptian. My father was American. My mother was Palestinian. My father had an American passport. We were born American. We had never been to America. And I had a very strange name. My first name is Edward, which is of course not an Arabic name. I was named because my mother was enchanted with the Prince of Wales. So I had this odd first name. And I had this even more odd last name because, Saeed is a very common name in Arabic, but my father's family was not called Saeed. It was called, well, in those days in Palestine, you were simply called after your father. So my father's name was Wadi Ibrahim. And then Saeed was added later, at the time, probably in the 20s, as a kind of generic name for the clan. And so the moment I became conscious of myself, in whether it was in Cairo, but especially in Cairo, I was always the odd person out. I went to an English school, but I wasn't English, I wasn't Egyptian, I was Arab, but I didn't have an Arabic name. And I spent all of my life really negotiating between these different aspects of my background, especially the languages, because I never really knew what my first language was, whether it was Arabic or English. And lastly, we lived, because we had no relatives in Egypt at all, so we lived in a kind of cocoon. My parents created a kind of a myth for us, that we were a nice, happy family, straight out of some book that they had read. My closest friend, really, in my growing up was my mother. So it was, as Carl suggested, it was a very odd, intense, in its own way, very satisfying, but also very crippling relationship.
Absolutely. We should move into that, I think. And I would say that it is also the more disturbing part of it. In a way, this book is really about your relation to your parents, and I would say specifically your mother. Right. I mean, all the book is more or less about this at the core. And of course, you say somewhere in the beginning, I think, that all parents try to invent their children. I think that's a very good point. But you say also that there were always something wrong with how I was invented. When you read this, also the endless effort from your parents, and specifically your mother, to reshape you, and also creating what I feel, at least, as a rather oppressive environment, and an environment of ambivalence, mm-hmm. and uncertainty. That was the main trick of your mother, I feel. But now, when you look back at all this, what kind of feeling do you have? I mean, from one point of view, you could feel, this was my childhood. It was a rather oppressive time of my life.
You know, it's funny. I that's not what I mainly remember. I know it comes across in the book, but if you read the book in another way, you'll see that my mother, of course, was the source of a lot of my unhappiness. Certainly, the feeling I had that I wasn't doing well and that I disappointed her. But you see, she was a very ambivalent woman, immensely charming, very beautiful, very elegant. And at the same time, she was very loving. I mean, I was obviously her favorite child. There were five of us. I was the oldest. I was a boy. And then I had four sisters, all of whom are very unhappy with my book, as it turns out, because their experiences of my parents were quite different, obviously. As the only son, and this is where, you know, I think I emphasized it quite a bit in the book. My mother was also the source of the things that mattered the most to me. That is to say, she was the one who encouraged my interest in music. She was the one who encouraged my interest in literature. My father was a very silent man. He was almost Bergman-esque that way. And he was the one who tried to literally to shape me, I mean physically. Perhaps we'll talk about that later. But my mother was the one who really believed in me, you see. And when she was positive, and she was a very emotional woman, she made me feel like a prince, you know. And she validated me, and she understood that I had a certain capacity or gift or talent, whatever, for language and for music, and that I was clever and so on and so forth. And that, when it came forth from her, made it possible for me to do things that I didn't think I could do on my own without her. But on the other hand, my mother also had this extraordinary capacity, perhaps due to her early childhood, which had unhappy moments in it, to turn it off. And when she turned it off, I felt completely desolate and tried my best. My ambition then became entirely to regain my mother's love and approbation. And sometimes it took a long time, but in the end, she always came back. And of course, I saw her when she was dying, and then there there the feelings were very, very complicated, of tremendous frustration, because my mother was a very alert woman, and she had metastasized cancer, and she refused to have chemotherapy. Sort of interesting. I had a lot of it, but she didn't want to because she thought it would make her worse. So she slowly died of metastatic cancer in her brain. So she lost her mind. And in her last days, I was very conscious of her saying to me, I mean, and that's so typical of a Palestinian story. She'd say, I want to go home. She was in Washington at the time. And I would always ask her, where do you want to go? And she said, I just want to go home. And we never really got to the point of saying where home was, because she had moved so much, you know, first Palestine, then Lebanon, then Egypt, then back to Lebanon, then America. And if I could just say one last thing, because I hate immigration authorities. My mother came to America in the last 2 years of her life to be treated, or to be looked after by my sister. She wasn't treated, but she slowly died. But she came on a visa, which in the last 3 weeks of her life expired. And my sister had to go to court in Washington, because that's where they were, to prevent my mother being deported. And the case went right up through to a court, an immigration court. And luckily, the judge who saw the case and was aware of my mother, asking the immigration authorities, well, where is this woman now? And so he said, well, she's with a daughter. And my sister said, yes, she's with me. And what is her condition? And she said, she's dying. She's comatose. And so the judge was so incensed at the immigration authorities, he obviously threw the case out. But it seemed also to be typical of the Palestinian, that the question, and not just Palestinians, Kurds, Kosovans, North Africans, you know, Europe is now, the world is full of displaced persons. But this idea that just by a piece of paper you can stay or you must leave, etc., seems to have dogged our family really all of our lives. And my mother, in the end, really typified that fate, despite the fact that she was well off. Money is not a factor here.
You had, just referring to this immigration thing, a more comic situation of your father always thought that if you put her, your mother's passport under your American passport, she would automatically go into the country.
But no, they always got it out first.
Yeah, it never happened. Well, but going back to this relation, I mean, how would you like to describe your relation to your father?
Very difficult, because my father, as I said, was a silent man. And I begin at the end, because when my father died, he also died of cancer. We're a cancer-ridden family. And the last thing that my father did when I saw him for the last time, I had to come back to New York to my work, and he was on the verge of death. And I never forget, as long as I live, the fact that he said goodbye to me. He was in bed. And after having said goodbye, he turned his back to me and faced the wall. And in a sense, that sort of typified my father in a way, because he was not gifted with words at all. He was a numbers man. I mean, he had a phenomenal mathematical capacity, unlike any I've ever seen. He could add, subtract, multiply in his head like a calculator. He was, my mother would always say that my father loved me dearly. But he was unable to express that. But what he did express were injunctions, very Victorian ones. He wanted me to live cleanly. He was tremendously concerned about my posture, which is still bad. He was worried about my, every part of my body came under a kind of discipline straight out of Foucault. You know, that my back was hunched, that my stomach wasn't strong enough, that my arms weren't developed enough, that my my chin, he thought, was weak. And he pushed me very hard. That is to say, very little seemed to satisfy my father. It was all, I'll never forget the thing that always in school, I never did brilliantly in school, but I was, as my mother used to say, I was too smart for them ever to throw me out. But at every school occasion, my father would go up to the teacher and say, how did Edward do? And the teacher would always say, oh, he did quite well. My father would say, but he didn't do his best, did he? And so, so the teacher always would say, no, no, I guess he didn't, or something like that. Until I graduated from university and my father and my mother came all the way from Egypt to Princeton and spoke to my philosophy professor, who was the only person, I think, who ever replied to my father. And said to him, when my father said, but he didn't do his best, did he? And my philosophy professor looked at my father, put his arm, he's a very short man, Arthur Zathmer, his name was a professor of aesthetics, and he said, what are you talking about? Who can do his best anyway? Nobody can do his best. My father was completely stunned at this. So he was very hard, but on the other hand, he was an extraordinarily generous man. I mean, he never allowed me to want for anything, so long as it was concerned with doing good, that there were certain things, education, the improvement of character, the development of one's musical, intellectual taste, even though my father wasn't that interested in them. Once, I remember he came to visit me, it's the last story I'll mention, he came to visit me in New York, where I have a lot of books, as most people do in my profession. And he looked at the books like that. He said, did you read all those books? I said, well, you know, some of them. He said, you know, I'm really worried about you, Edward. I said, well, he said, it's not good to read too many books.
Maybe. But I mean, there was always, you'll come back to this, various points, in fact, to this feeling of shame. And,
yes.
And you were always told that, you, as you said, you didn't do your best and you didn't fulfill the expectations of your parents, and they rubbed it in and rubbed it in. Do you still have that kind of feeling of shame that you're not really...
Well, yeah, guilt, I would say. I
mean,
they built into me, because both of my parents were Protestant, and I think, I mean, sweet, you, all of you, I mean, most of you here probably understand what I'm talking about, but you can make somebody feel guilty before the trial, really, you know, that you're guilty as charged. And you spend the rest of your life trying to earn, not exactly redemption, but some form of grace. And I frequently think that the fact that I'm driven, that I work very hard, etc., has a lot to do with the sense of my parents telling me, oh, Edward, you didn't work hard enough, or you're not concentrating, or there you go, goofing off. But I think a lot of it had to do, and this is something that's a little difficult to talk about, and in a way, I should say, by the way, that my book, for the Arabs who've read it, of course, I wrote the book in English, obviously, but it's about to appear in an Arabic translation, I think, this month, October. But some of it, of course, a lot of Arabs read English, but nearly all of the Arab friends that I have, including obviously my sisters, but other people not related to me who are Western educated and so on, were rather, how shall I put it, rather disturbed by my book. Because in our tradition, I mean, even the books I've read in Arabic, there are a lot of autobiographies, most of them follow the formula, which I grew up with, but I never believed, that you always protect your family. That there, for example, if you look at the standard autobiographies in Arabic, Taha Hussein, Tawfiq Hakim, great, many of them classics, beautiful books. The mother is always a saintly creature, the father, of course, is stern, but loving, etc. In my case, the story is more complicated by the stories I tell and the secrets, I suppose you could call them that, that I reveal about the family, because I think it's terribly important to be absolutely honest in what happened. In particular, where I think my childhood was a difficult one, it was extremely repressed. And sex was a very, very, very difficult subject for both my parents. I mean, I didn't even know the names, much less the activities, connected with the sexual parts. And my parents, especially my father, were relentless in their attempts to prevent me from, for example, Freud. Both my parents were readers, and there was a Freud. And one day, and I was a very curious kid, and I was quite talented in reading. I read everything. But one day they saw me reading a volume of Freud. I forget which one it was. Also another volume, which I recall, called Ideal Marriage. You find it in many homes. I don't think anymore, because kids know more than their parents. Anyway, the moment they saw me reading these books, they disappeared. The books were just taken off the shelves, and I never saw them again. And so the whole question of sexuality, of dealing with the opposite sex, the relationship between boys and girls, I mean, all of a sudden my sisters and I, we were growing up together, and all of a sudden we were separated because my father felt that too much exposure of boys to girls and girls to boys was bad. I never went out with a girl, really, until I was about 18, because I went to segregated schools, you know, boys-only schools, where there were no girls, and girls were always off-limits, and always connected, in particular in Cairo. Cairo was the great sin city of the Orient, right? So all around were the enticements of the great city, the sexual favors of women, you know, of prostitutes, of cabarets, etc., etc. And I had the feeling, looking back on it, but as I was growing up, that my parents were standing there, you know, or like the boy with the finger in the dike, you know, to prevent the flood from coming, to keep sex away, to all kinds of degrees. I mean, it was censoring books, not luck, for example. When I was 12 or 13 years old, there was a film I desperately wanted to see called A Duel in the Sun, which I still haven't seen, by the way. But it was reputed to be a very naughty film, and my mother forbade us to see it. In those days, of course, even Hollywood films were highly censored. This was a film with Jennifer Jones and Joseph Cotten, and it had very seductive posters, but my mother said, no, you can't see it, it's not for children. So there developed in my imaginary, a whole group of actresses connected to the illicit, including Jennifer Jones. But it was all right to see her in Bernadette, but not in that film, because Bernadette was saintly and all the rest of it, and therefore without any sex. Certain kinds of, Jane Russell was forbidden. I don't know if she means anything to you here. You're all too young, probably, to know these things. But so there was a system of control, which in the end, of course, I'm glad to say I escaped.
Well, turning to politics for a while, it's also interesting. You note that there was no politics
not at all
in your home, and you said that politics always seemed to involve other people, not us.
Right.
And that was still, I mean, remember the background, the dramatic events, the Palestinian War and so forth.
So, World War II?
Yes, exactly. So politics was out, really, of your family. I mean, this, I guess, was around a traditional bourgeois position, right, in a way, well known also from my own background, but even less traumatic. What I would like to say is, how did you get into politics?
Well, only through the back door. I mean, I looking back on it, and that's one of the advantages of writing something like this, is you begin to discover that your whole life, at least my whole life, was really surrounded by turbulence all around. I mean, I came to consciousness during World War II, and World War II in the Middle East meant, for us at any rate, the German invasion of North Africa and the movement east of Rommel, so that the Battle of Alamein, where Montgomery stopped him, directly concerned us, because before that, when Rommel advanced to Tobruk, my father, who was an American citizen, decided that it was unsafe for us to remain in Cairo, so we were put in a car, and I talk about it in the book, and we drive across the west, the Sinai, to Palestine, to evade the German armies, who were stopped and didn't come to Cairo. But when we came back, we saw, of course, the British troops. I grew up with British troops all around me. So Egypt was in a state of constant turbulence, governments being changed all the time. This was the last days of the British. But also Palestine, where my family's business was as well as Cairo, and all my family lived in Palestine. My youth in Palestine was growing up with the sounds and the news I would hear of the fights between the Palestinians and the Jews, between the Palestinians and the British, and between the Jews and the British. I remember the blowing up of the King David Hotel in 1946, and I was in Palestine in 1947, and the place we lived in, where the family house was, where I was born at home, and I was in the hospital, was about 100 meters away from a British base. So I would watch the soldiers marching up and down, practicing. But I never really understood what they were there for. I took it as a natural thing that the British belonged there, because they spoke about it as if it was their place. And certainly growing up in Cairo and Palestine, in English schools, I assumed that Britain was the center of the world. I knew more about English history, English geography, the English language in a grammatical way, than I did about my own. I mean, I knew nothing about the Arab world. We were brainwashed as the elites of that part of the world to become, in a sense, replicas of the British, to serve them. But being naturally rebellious and seeing always the British as the other, who treated, I must say, that you could even see it as a child, you could see it in the teacher, who would say, for example, well, we're getting home this summer. And I'd say, well, where's home? I mean, I thought this, you know, no, home is in England, it's not me. And then as we grew older, as I grew older, I went to a very famous school in Cairo called Victoria College, right? It was a state of complete and total war between, there were no English students. They were all Arabs and Armenians and Italians and Jews and Greeks. And all the teachers were English. And all the teachers were English, who treated us like the natives, you know, and they were the sort of. And so there was, and I was a ringleader in that. I hated them. And because one of their, you won't believe this, but in Egypt, it's like Algeria in a way, we were required to speak only English. The first rule, we were all given a little book, you know, like this, when we became students, Victoria College, the elite school of the Middle East. And it said, rule number one, the first rule of the school is English is the language of the school. Anyone caught speaking any other language will be punished. So you couldn't speak your own language, you had to speak their language. So there was that sense. And then of course they were thrown out. And so I developed very early a political consciousness of some sort, of us versus them, of the colonial struggle, which I lived. But I couldn't express it until, and then I came to America. And the thing I responded to in America, which was quite interesting, in America, my father sent me away at the age of 15. I went to a boarding school. It was the most miserable experience of my life because I'd never been there. I'd never even seen snow. You know, I come from a hot country, I go to a cold place. But the thing that immediately impressed me about America, which has guided me ever since, is that at least the English were honest. They said, you are the underlings, we are the masters. In America, it was always put in another way, you know. Saeed, you don't have enough leadership quality. The notion, this is an important philological discovery, the notion of leadership is an American invention to conceal power. In other words, only certain people are allowed to rule, not everybody can, and you're not the right person. So there's a sense of the accepted way of doing things. And then, of course, in America, from the very beginning, I discovered how poorly the Americans thought of the Arabs and Muslims. It was from the way that it was covered in the press, so that by the time of the 67 war, with my entire background up in flames, I mean, Egypt was destroyed, the rest of Palestine was lost to Israel, Jordan was, you know, the West Bank, etc., was taken from them, they occupied the Sinai, this is the Israelis, and America was really Israeli occupied. It was Israeli-occupied territory. And so there, I felt that it was the only thing I could do if I had to have a political life was to enter the battle on the level of writing and representation and discourse. And that's where my political sense developed, through friends, because in 67 was a great turning point for us all. A number of my friends left America and went back and joined the Palestinian movement. The first time in my whole life that there was an independent Palestinian movement born in Jordan. And from then on, I was involved politically and expanded my horizons to include much more of the world than I knew about when I grew up.
So in a way, you got your political education in a way in the United States, you can say. Of course, you went back quite often and met your friends and people.
Well, I got my political education in a certain way already. Growing up in Palestine and Egypt, as I say, and when we would go to Lebanon in the summers, Lebanon was part of Vichy France, you know, it was ruled by the French mandate. And my first awareness of politics then was the presence of a colonial other, the person with authority. And immediately, my first experience with any of them was always a sense of rebellion and insurrection. I felt that they were against me, therefore I had to be against them. But it was only later that I began to discover the reasons. But the experiences were early.
But you have lived, most of your life, in fact, in the United States. And
in New York.
In New York, yes. That's a different thing.
That's not the United States.
Absolutely.
I couldn't live in the rest of the place.
No, I was just going to ask about that. Because, you have been there, you are not only critical against the, highly critical against the U.S. policy in the Middle East, but also, you are a sharp and, I think, critics of the American civilization, so to say, the culture or mentality, but you have still accommodated your...
Well, yes and no. In other words, what I've found to be really, in a sense, intellectually, what interests me the most is the discovery of, to use a phrase from John Pilger, hidden agendas. They'll say they're doing one thing, but in fact they're doing another. And, for example, looking back at my own education in English schools, they say they're educating you, but in fact they're training you to be subordinate, right? So, for me, I became a teacher. That's what my profession is. And in America, I think it's terribly important to try and awaken one's students. I don't teach politics, by the way, I teach literature. I've never taught anything to do with politics in my classes, or certainly never the Middle East, about which I've written a great deal. But, in fact, what I try to train my students in is critical thinking, because so much of what we're given, whether through the media or through education, which is always nationalist to begin with, we are the center of the world. Everybody thinks he's the center of the world. I think it's true in Sweden, probably. Your children are taught to think that Sweden is the most immovable. The story is always the same. So, first of all, to show that there are others in the world, and that we're not the only people, to try to break the hold on people of these, what Blake calls mind-forged manacles, the imprisonments of education, background, family. It took me 40 years to discover that what my parents thought about X and Y and Z was simply wrong. And I remember the thing that used to infuriate me as I grew older with my mother. I'd say, "Well, Mother, how do you know that Mrs. Frank here really is an atheist?" Which is, in our circles, is a great, great accusation. She said, "Oh, everybody knows she's an atheist." Well, I said, "But how do we, So investigating the everybody knows is really terribly important for me to get at. And that this, in fact, is connected to something that we always felt growing up was not our business, because we were always out of place. In other words, my father was an American, he was a Christian, he was a Palestinian. We lived in Egypt, or we lived in Lebanon, or even we lived in Palestine. We were always somehow different from the majority. So the thing is, you could either teach yourself to act like a minority, in which case you become defensive and quiet, you try to fade into the background, or you can be a minority and think as if you're a member of the majority, which is what I always felt. I never felt I was a Christian. I felt I was an Arab. In other words, one can choose the larger identity rather than the smaller one. The most disillusioning thing for me was the Lebanese Civil War, which is, you know, Lebanon is about the size of Gothenburg. I mean, it's a tiny country, okay? And there must have been about 10 factions. It started out as Christians versus Muslims, but then it became Greek Orthodox versus Maronite, Sunni versus Shia. I mean, things you've never heard of. In the end, they were fighting street versus street, because the tendency of separatist identities and the whole question of identity politics that's fascinated me all my life has been to get smaller and smaller and smaller. I mean, if you say we have to defend against X and Y and Z, you know, this Huntington thing, clash of civilizations. Well, in the end, the West that you're defending becomes tiny, because if you look carefully, there's no such thing as a simple identity. All identities are mixed. So rather than think with one tiny identity, I think it's much more interesting to think with several identities, which in fact we all have. I mean, there's no such thing as a Western identity or an Arab identity. Arabs are made up of people who speak Arabic. That's basically the formula. And if you think in those terms, then I think you can free yourself from a lot of the provincialism and xenophobia which exists in places like the United States, where I think the advantage of New York is, of course, New York is an exile city, really. It's a city made up of wandering people who have stopped in New York. You know, it's like the taxi drivers you meet all the time. And you say, where are you from, with a Muslim name? Muhammad, where are you from? I always ask them. Are you from Pakistan? He said, no, Bangladesh. I said, do you like it here? He said, nah, I hate it. I said, well, why are you here? Good job. And then I go back. So that's the sense you get in New York, that everybody's there because it's a good place to work. But the idea of affiliation of the land, the blood and land and all those horrible things that people seem to be attached to is not to be found there. And I think the idea of somehow breaking some of these very primal bonds that in the end are really crippling, I think, are what drives me.
Well, another point which is important in your life, and that is music. Very important also in your professional life, really, and the relation between music and other arts and literature and so forth. There was a very fascinating and moving, I would say, interview with you and Daniel Barenboim, the famous conductor, and you had a friendship together, and you worked together. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I met Barenboim, of course, is an Israeli, and I met him about 8 years ago in the lobby of a hotel in London where we were both staying. And I was interested in him now, because I'm interested in music. But I was also interested because I read his memoir, in which he talks about his sense that Israel has to break out of its isolation and it has to get more integrated into the Islamic and Arabic world, which I thought was an unusual sentiment for a musician and an Israeli musician to talk about. Anyway, we became friends. And we've done a number of things together, including have public conversations about music and politics and so on and so forth. But last summer, there was a very extraordinary thing happened. In a way, neither of us was interested in the politics of this, but rather the musical aspect of it. Last year, Weimar, which as you know is the great East German city, birthplace of residence of Goethe, where everybody was there. Bach was there, Beethoven was there, Goethe was there, Schumann was there, Liszt, Wagner, Schiller lived there. It was the cultural capital of Europe, and they had asked Barenboim to come and give a concert. He is the director, or has been the director, of the Staatsoper in Berlin. So I happened to be in Berlin when this came, and he said to me, what about doing something unusual? So I said, well, why don't we do something based on the Westöstlicher Divan of Goethe? Goethe wrote this fantastic long series of poems, the Divan, based on his readings of Arabic, but mainly Persian poetry. Hafiz in particular, but he was also very interested in Islam. And so what we did, we engaged, who he happened to be there also in Berlin at the time, Yo-Yo Ma, and we spent a year going through the Middle East. I did a little video and this video talking about the project, which was to bring musicians from the Arab world and from Israel to Weimar for 2 or 3 weeks in the summer of 1999. It happened again this year, but last year was more interesting because it was longer, to play music. And everybody came. I mean, the Syrians, you know, even though they knew that Barenboim was Israeli and that there would be Israeli musicians, they sent 10 musicians. The Egyptians had 18 of them. The end was a result of about 78 young musicians from Israel and all the Arab countries, Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan, etc. And the balance Israelis, and they hired 12 Germans to fill out the orchestra of 90. There were master classes with Barenboim and with Yo-Yo Ma, and with the first desk players of the Berlin Philharmonic. And every evening after the sessions, which began at 9 in the morning, Barenboim would rehearse the orchestra for 4 hours, from 9:30 to 1, measure by measure. Amazing, because he didn't ever have any music in front of him. Everything was done by memory. And then again, from 4 until 8, and in between, the kids would have classes in chamber music and in their own instruments. And then after dinner in the evening, usually about 8:30 or 9, we would have, all of the students would come, and there would be a discussion. I was the Diskussionsleiter, the leader of the discussion. Everything under the sun, including such questions as, can, for instance, the Arab kids would be playing Arabic music by themselves at night, at 11, and nobody slept. And then there was a question of, who can play Arabic music? So there was an Israeli boy who tried to enter the Arabic music improvisation. He was a violinist from Albania. And so the Arab students said, no, 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 we can't. Arab music is only for Arabs because it's in our blood. So then, of course, I said, well, why are you playing Beethoven? It's not in your blood. I mean, so everything became open and possible through music. It was quite extraordinary. And then there was an Israeli boy, I'll never forget this extraordinary story, I'll end with this. There was an Israeli boy who said, I don't want to be here. I mean, these are people, I'm in the army, and when I go back, I'm going to be sent to Lebanon. And I don't want to become too friendly with these people because I may have to shoot them. By the end of the 3 weeks, he had fallen in love with a Syrian violinist. And I was there when they left on their buses to go back to the airport and back to their homes. They were crying. It was really quite extraordinary. It's just an idea for me of the way music in particular, to which you cannot give words, that's the interesting thing. I mean, nobody was talking about peace or conflict or history or 1948 or 1967 or the peace process as they're trying to play, let's say, the third movement of the Beethoven Seventh Symphony. You know, you have to concentrate on that. So it's a way of sort of muddling the stupidities and the what I call the janitorial aspects of politics, where it's just a matter of arrangements. That a new configuration might be possible, and where equality of performance, rather than differences of ethnic and religious backgrounds, is the important thing. It was an extraordinary theory.
I think that would be the optimistic note where we should end this conversation, really. The passion and power of music also to open our mind. Thank you, everyone.